Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Federal officials are trying to ease concerns that there might not be enough swine flu vaccine this fall. Today they said they're rushing to package 85 million shots by the end of October, which is 2 weeks later than expected. Even so, that's still not enough to inject about 160 million people, pregnant women, children, and healthcare workers who are at the top of the priority list. Health officials are bracing for the H1N1 virus to spread even further once school starts for more kids because it still largely affects young people. Dr. William Schaffner is chairman of the Preventive Medicine Department at Vanderbilt University, and he joins us on the line. And Dr. Schaffner, concerns that there won't be enough vaccines soon enough, does that worry you?
Well, it worries us somewhat. Of course, we're going to get a little bit less, in fact, a great deal less, on October 15th than we had anticipated, but 20 million doses will be coming in every week. I think we'll all be working very hard to distribute the vaccine that we have on hand. This H1N1 virus is going to do what it's going to do. I actually anticipate that we will have outbreaks once the schools get together, and I'm just hoping that the vaccine gets here before the outbreaks do.
And I understand, though, that we may not have what we thought we were going to have by October 15th, but also we need not just one dose. We need two shots for full immunity.
The clinical trials haven't been done yet. They haven't been completed, but we anticipate that's going to be the word. So we'll all have to get one inoculation and then, in likelihood, wait 3 weeks and go back for a second dose.
And who should get these doses? We mentioned pregnant women, toddlers, healthcare workers. Are those the folks mainly on the priority list?
Yes, young children and young adults up through about 24 years of age. Those people who also care for children under 6 months of age, because we can't vaccinate them, and if they get influenza, those infants, they get very, very ill, so we'd like to protect everybody else around them. And then expanding things a little bit, older adults who particularly have underlying conditions that predispose them to the complications of influenza.
If people can't get a vaccine, should they take other flu drugs like Tamiflu or Relenza?
That's taking those drugs in order to prevent the illness. We reserve that to people who are already very, very frail and likely to become terribly sick with influenza. Mostly we're saving those drugs for treatment, such that if you get sick and you need treatment, we will have the drug available for you.
If it does get worse, once school is in session for most kids across the country, what should parents do now to prepare?
Wonderful question. Parents should figure, if my child gets ill, who's going to do the child care? They should plan for that right now so they don't have to do it in a crisis environment if their child should get sick. They should know that their child should not go to school if they're ill. They should also emphasize hand washing and good hygiene at home. And once influenza hits the community, a little bit of what we call social distancing might be in order. I like to put it this way. It might be time to rent a movie rather than going to the movie.
When should someone call a medical professional?
Yeah, particularly those individuals who have any kind of underlying illness might have that conversation with their pediatricians, family doctors now, so that they know when their doctor wants them to call. But certainly, if you really feel ill, you should not hesitate to get in touch with your healthcare provider.
Vanderbilt is one of the places where the vaccine is being tested. I understand you've been vaccinated.
I have been vaccinated. I volunteered.
Now there are some folks who say, particularly because the swine flu appears to affect young people, there are some who are questioning the safety of these types of vaccines, especially if there is a possibility that they might contain the preservative that has mercury in it, thimerosal. Does the swine flu vaccine have thimerosal in it? And if it does, is it safe?
Well, the swine flu vaccine, the H1N1 vaccine, will have some formulations that come in multi-dose vials that will contain trace amounts of thimerosal, and they will also have thimerosal-free formulations, and of course we'll also have the nasal spray variety, which is thimerosal-free. If you would like the thimerosal-free variety, speak up, because it should be widely available. Now, let's pause for a moment. We give influenza vaccine on an annual basis in the millions upon tens of millions of doses. It's our safest vaccine, and science now has closed the book on the thimerosal controversy. Thimerosal is not associated with adverse effects.
All right. Dr. William Schaffner, Chairman of the Preventative Medicine Department at Vanderbilt University, thanks very much for being with us.
Deborah, a pleasure.
In and around cities across America, homeless heroin addicts often set up makeshift encampments where they essentially live while going about the daily struggle to get their fix. Anthropologist Philippe Bourgois spent more than a decade in some of these encampments around San Francisco, and he says he learned a lot about how addicts survive, why people become addicted, and that the way we deal with addicts needs to change. Bourgois is co-author of the new book, Righteous Dope Fiend, which tells the addict's story in text and in graphic photographs taken by his colleague, Jeff Schoenberg. You can see some of the photos at our website, hereandnow.org. Bourgois is a professor of anthropology at the University of Pennsylvania, and I asked him to explain his book's title, Righteous Dope Fiend.
It's a street term that's commonly used by especially the older generation of long-term heroin addicts. And it's a contradictory term, obviously, righteous dope fiend. What the heck does that mean? And what it implies is that they're dedicated to being heroin addicts. They're not ashamed of it. And it's sort of an admission of both surrender and on some way a celebration of being a heroin addict. Dope, by the way, on the street only means heroin. It doesn't mean marijuana or whatever else. Dope is the word for heroin.
What made you decide that you wanted to look at this particular group?
Well, I lived in San Francisco for 20 years, and I couldn't go anywhere without running into, face-to-face, a homeless person. And I wanted to figure out, who are these people that are asking me for spare change? Are they addicted to drugs? Do they need my money? How do they survive? You know, what is this mystery? And there was always about a dozen people in the scene that I befriended at any given period of time. And over the 12 years that I spent time following them, there were probably about 75 people who I got to know very well. And those are primarily men with about 10 to 20% women. And basically, I would hang out with them. I'd go down, let's say, maybe 11 o'clock in the morning, and then come home around 2 o'clock in the morning so that I'd see sort of the range. And then the next thing I knew, I would find myself out there all night. And it really feels like you're going into an alternate universe. I mean, you come out just totally exhausted, and you can't believe the real world, you know, is still normal out there after everything that you've seen.
Yeah, I mean, the images that you have in the book, the photographs, are really unbelievable, and they really do show this almost alternate universe of tarps protecting these little areas that are an encampment under freeway overpasses where they basically use a lot of garbage and things that most of us would throw away or old furniture and almost create a community there. Is that right?
Well, they create a community, really. I mean, as an anthropologist, one has to recognize it is a real community. It's not a healthy community. It's a community of addicted bodies, essentially. And what's very bizarre about this is exactly how you just described it. This mini universe is literally maybe 3 yards, 5 yards at most, from the sidewalk where literally hundreds of people are walking by every day. And somehow all the passersby aren't noticing this universe that's right next to them. And I mean, that's what this project was sort of about, was rendering the invisible pariahs visible to America.
And then what was it like in that little area? Tell me what it smelled like.
Well, yeah, the first thing that hits you, unfortunately, is the smell. And I think that's probably what keeps most people out. It takes a while to get used to that, because basically they're living in the same places where they're defecating. And so I don't want to go into too much detail there, but the garbage trucks are obviously not coming through there. There's no sanitation whatsoever.
So how does someone like you, an academic, go into a situation like this and gain their trust? I'm sure you don't just approach them and say, hey, mind if I watch you guys shoot heroin for a couple of years?
You know, believe it or not, I know it sounds crazy, but that is what I do. I just
really
walk right up to them and say, hey, I'm an anthropologist. psychology professor, and I write books about life on the street, and I'm really interested in you guys. Can I hang out here? And then what I've discovered over the years of doing this kind of field work on the street is that when you treat people with respect who are basically pariahs, who are outcasts in society, they respond well to being treated with respect. So they loved having me around. They would introduce me to anyone who didn't know me as my professor. Hey, this is my professor who I've been telling you about. Because, you know, people wouldn't believe them when they would tell someone, hey, this professor thinks I'm really important. He wants to write a book about me.
But you also have to figure out who to trust and what to trust. In the book, your field notes talk directly about what was happening at the time, and you also transcribe some of the interviews. And some of the information is very confusing. So how do you know what's truthful in terms of making a representation of these stories?
Well, that's why we spent 12 years on this project. By getting people to repeat things to you over a several-year period and getting the story from, you know, five different people, or getting the person to tell you the stories in front of different people, you start getting at the truth. And we followed up by seeking out the family members of the homeless and corroborating stuff. We also look stuff up in the press and archives, and we present all that in the book and how we figured out what to believe and what was understated, because also there's things they don't want to talk about that you only uncover after years and years of knowing them.
So give me a specific example. Is there one story that stands out in particular for you?
Sure. There's a main character who we changed his name to Hank, and he had a particularly traumatic childhood. His father was basically a hardcore alcoholic, and he presented himself to the world as a Vietnam War veteran. And, I mean, he manifested all the symptoms of being a Vietnam War veteran. If we'd be walking down the street together and a car would backfire, he would literally hit the ground. And when he had drunk too much, he would start, you know, crying and sobbing about, you know, friends that he had lost in the Vietnam War. So I honestly believed he was a Vietnam veteran. Basically, we got his Veterans Administration, you know, record, and it turned out he hadn't been in Vietnam. Then we dealt a little further. We found his sister, and we told him the story, and it turns out that his father used to shoot guns in the house. You know, was an incredibly dangerous and violent man, kept guns in the house and would shoot them and then point them at the kids. And he was in wrestling matches with his father over the gun. So we realized this guy has PTSD, post-traumatic stress, you know, from his childhood abuse with his father. But the only way to be sort of a dignified homeless pariah in the United States is to have a Vietnam War identity, because then people, you know, sort of give you a shred of excuse for being such a visible failure. So he was trying to hang on to a sense of dignity by holding on to a Vietnam identity that, you know, technically wasn't his.
That's Philippe Bourgois, a professor of anthropology at the University of Pennsylvania Medical School. When we come back, what should be done about homeless addicts? How about the idea of prescribing heroin? Back in a minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We're talking with Philippe Bourgois, anthropology professor at the University of Pennsylvania. He spent more than a decade with heroin addicts in encampments they set up around San Francisco. And his work is documented with some stunning photographs by Jeff Schoenberg in the book Righteous Dope Fiend. Many of the addicts that he depicts were between 40 and 50 years old. Many had families they could stay with, but they chose to live and sleep on the streets because of their drug problem. Bourgois says for the addicts to get the 40 or so dollars they needed for heroin every day, most would panhandle, some would do day labor or scavenge for recycling, maybe some would steal from people or perhaps shoplift. I asked Bourgois to explain how these addicts, given the challenges they faced on a daily basis, managed to survive.
You know, these people are survivors. I think those that had weak systems basically died. And tragically, during the 12 years that we worked with this group of homeless heroin injectors, about half of them died, and another remaining quarter are not going to live much longer. They have emphysema, cirrhosis, you know, terrible conditions related primarily to smoking and alcohol. Those two legal drugs, ironically, are much worse for your organs. They're actually more debilitating to your organs than opiates are, the, you know, what heroin is made out of. What's dangerous about the heroin is the way you inject it. You inject it with dirty needles, which then give you hepatitis C and HIV and terrible, terrible abscesses. And that's because they're injecting in these filthy environments because it's illegal, essentially.
Right. Well, let's talk about legal and illegal. Where are the police in all of this? You say that many, you know, these encampments are invisible to many of us walking right by. What about law enforcement?
For the most part, in large cities, law enforcement doesn't want to be bothered by these old, harmless, long-term heroin addicts. And they actually represent the majority of heroin addicts. They're not committing violent crime. They're actually often sort of stabilizing neighborhoods because they don't want, you know, violent crime to be committed around them because they don't want trouble with the police. So the judges don't want to be bothered by these people either. They're seeing our prisons are completely overcrowded. And a lot of the judges actually are beginning to recognize that these people need medical care, not criminal care. They need addiction treatment, you know, subsidized housing. They need social workers, mental health treatment, and above all, drug treatment.
So why aren't these people put into some sort of treatment program, and why aren't people paying attention?
Good question. Right now, the policy that we've got with homeless heroin injectors and crack smokers is probably the most expensive, stupidest policy that you could have. Basically, what we're doing is we're arresting them and throwing them in jail and often busting them on very petty, sort of minor drug sales, because that's another way they make their money, is by sort of selling drugs to one another. But these are tiny amounts of drugs. I mean, these are these $5 bags. And they'll get sent to prison for whatever, 2 years at whatever, $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 a year it costs to keep someone in jail, when we should be providing them with the kinds of social services that will stop costing so much money. And one of the things, for example, that works well, it's called Housing First, where your first priority is get someone housed in an inexpensive studio. In the case of California, you've got a lot of single residence occupancy hotels, and it's been very successful because when you can keep someone housed, you can start getting them, you know, preventive care, you can start getting them a social worker and mental health care and drug treatment and so forth. But what it requires is that you tolerate non-disruptive substance use. Because right now, according to federal guidelines, if anyone is using an illegal drug in subsidized housing, that entire family gets thrown out. Right. Not just the person, but the entire family gets thrown out. It's the famous zero tolerance policy. And instead, what municipalities and states are doing is they're not using federal funds so that they can tolerate non-disruptive alcohol and drug use. And that's a lot cheaper than throwing someone out on the street and turning them into a violent criminal and turning them into basically a festering sore of abscesses that then hits the emergency room. And then you're put in the intensive care unit for 6 weeks, you know, at whatever it is, $16,000 a day. And then you're patched up. And as soon as you can hobble out, you're thrown out on the street again. It's just a stupid way to spend money.
But there are some folks who probably are thinking, why should I have sympathy for someone who has a habit like this and doesn't want to stop injecting themselves? Where does personal responsibility come into all of this?
You know, that's a very important question. And I think what we have to do is be pragmatic about this and realize that these are basically traumatized sick people. I mean, if you're not swayed by the physical suffering argument, then just be really hard-nosed and pragmatic. Why do you want to spend a fortune putting these people in jail? Why do you want to spend a fortune putting these people in hospitals when we could spend that money more wisely through preventive care and cheap subsidized housing? The most pragmatic of all is the solution that Switzerland has done. And that is to take their hardcore long-term heroin addicts and prescribe them heroin. And once you start prescribing them heroin, supervised by a nurse in a safe injection site, basically that person's problems, for the most part, go away, or the sort of the acute part of the problems go away. And then they can start even addressing the more fundamental problems that they have of, you know, why the heck are they addicted to a drug that has consumed their life like this? And Switzerland does this now as a matter of policy. It costs them a lot less. And ironically, a higher proportion of these addicts who are prescribed heroin eventually completely quit heroin and become drug-free than those that are prescribed methadone or buprenorphine or the other forms of drug replacement therapy.
That's Philippe Bourgois, professor of anthropology at the University of Pennsylvania. He and his colleague, Jeff Schoenberg, documented the lives of homeless heroin addicts in San Francisco in their book, Righteous Dope Fiend. To view some of the photos, go to our website, hereandnow.org. And tomorrow on Here and Now, amid continuing violence, the people of Afghanistan get ready to vote. The BBC's Lise Doucette joins us to preview Thursday's elections. That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, two film geeks duke it out. What was the best year for American movie making, 1939 or 1999? We'll be back after the news, Here and Now. In Sri Lanka, heavy rains have destroyed or damaged hundreds of shelters housing ethnic Tamils. Nearly 300,000 refugees have been living in camps since the Tamil Tiger rebel fighters were defeated by the government in May. The minority Tamils waged a 25-year-long civil war against the majority Sinhalese, but they were finally cornered in a narrow sliver of the island, which is off the southern coast of India. The BBC's Charles Haviland joins us from Colombo, Sri Lanka. And Charles, can you describe conditions in the north?
There is a massive refugee camp. It's a sort of complex of camps. It's in six zones. It's called Menik Farm. And the rain came down very suddenly on Friday. In fact, I was also in northern Sri Lanka and witnessed it myself. It was absolutely torrential and very sudden in a part of the country that is normally quite arid and dry. And pictures were put on the web somehow by somebody inside the camp showing what looked like a kind of sea of mud. And the United Nations Humanitarian Affairs Office here in Colombo came out with a statement yesterday saying that basically one of the six zones was completely underwater, and in another, a lot of toilets, lavatories are submerged, with the water being contaminated with sewage. They also said that they didn't have any news from one of the zones of the camp. And I think this is an indication of the fact that just as journalists are mainly banned from those camps, even the humanitarian agencies, even the United Nations agencies, have very restricted access.
Now, human rights groups have been able to surmise, maybe access has been limited, but human rights groups do say that the ethnic Tamils are being held against their will. Why haven't some of them been allowed to return home?
The government says that these people were living with the Tamil Tigers, the LTTE, for a long time. They're really suspicious of this entire huge population. Primarily, they say that rebel fighters, even though the leaders of the rebels were killed, mainly in May, they say that rebel fighters may still be taking refuge and hiding among that population, and that they have to screen every man, woman, and child over 10 for possible rebel connections. They point out that the rebels, the Tamil Tigers, used to conscript children into their ranks. The government says that it has already detected more than 10,000 whom it describes as terrorists or rebels. And we don't know whether these are people who are said to have actually fought with the rebels or merely to be sympathisers, because government officials and ministers have repeatedly said that among those they want to weed out are sympathisers with the Tamil Tigers. Now, again, human rights groups are very exercised by this. They say, well, you can't really have the thought policing, Orwellian style, to that degree that you can really work out what people support. But the government would retort by saying it is very much determined that this country, which is, it says it has liberated from terrorism with the defeat of the Tamil Tigers, it says that this country must not be allowed to go back to being plagued by terror, and that it is taking these strict measures to prevent that happening. Human rights groups, as you say, are opposed to that, as are many governments, particularly Western governments, who have been traditionally allies of Sri Lanka, like the United States and the United Kingdom, just to name two, they are highly critical of the situation that's going on. Again, Sri Lanka is taking comfort in the fact that other countries, including China, Pakistan, Japan, a country that is very pro-Western in many ways, but are generally giving the nod and the wink to Sri Lanka and letting it do what it wants in this regard.
It doesn't sound like the civil war is really over.
Well, I think that might be an overstatement. I mean, the war is over. People in much of the country, if you talk to them, they are glad that they don't have to go in fear of terror attacks, for instance, on buses, for instance, here in the capital, Colombo, in the way that they did. But I think that there is a mental war still going on. And in terms of the military situation, you might think that with a war over, any government would be required to or would be expected to demilitarize a bit. Well, that is simply not happening here. The country has developed a very militarized mindset. And the army, the armed forces chief was saying just yesterday that, in fact, if you think we're going to demilitarize and loosen the security in northern Sri Lanka, think again, we're going to tighten it. So I don't think that life in northern Sri Lanka will return to any kind of pre-war normality in the foreseeable future, not even in the long term.
The BBC's Charles Haviland speaking with us from Colombo, Sri Lanka. Charles, thanks very much for being with us.
Pleasure.
And after a quick break today, they're not in our universe, but they are pretty interesting. Astronomers discover the first two planets to orbit their stars backward. It's Here and Now. Did you know that a planet can orbit backwards? Well, just last week, scientists identified two backwards orbiting planets, both of them outside our solar system. And here to tell us why these so-called retrograde planets are significant is Joshua Nguyen. He's assistant professor of physics at MIT. He also led the team that discovered the orbit of one of these planets. Welcome, Professor Nguyen.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, what does it mean that a planet is orbiting backwards?
Well, in the solar system, all the planets are orbiting the same way, and that's also the same direction that the Sun is spinning. What's different about these two new planets is that their orbits seem to be in the opposite direction as the rotation of the star that they're going around.
And so why is this so unusual? Has it never been found before?
It's true. It hasn't been found before, and nobody was really expecting it. The theory we have for how planets form around stars is that the planets and the star all form from a single spinning disk of material, and that would lead to systems like the solar system, where everything is well aligned. So it's a big surprise to find planets whose orbits are so tilted.
So does it mean, then, that our theory of how these planets are created is wrong?
It could be. So most of the ideas out there for how these planets came to be in these strange orbits involve them forming in the usual way, but then having something mess up their orbits and tilt them. It could have been that these systems have more than one planet in them, and that by chance there was a close encounter between two of these planets that might have sent the planet that we see today into its bizarre orbit.
Would they have collided into each other or something?
It's unlikely that they would have actually touched, but if they get close enough to each other, then their gravity can scramble the orbits.
Can you describe these two planets, where they are exactly and what we know about them?
Well, both planets are much more like Jupiter than like the Earth. They're large, they're probably made of hydrogen and helium, and even stranger is that they're very close to their parent stars. They're much closer to their stars than Mercury is to the Sun.
What do you think essentially this tells us, or how does it change our theories about our solar system?
Well, I'm really excited because this continues in the tradition of surprises among the planets around other stars. Everybody expected that when planets were finally discovered around other stars, they would be kind of like the solar system, where the giant planets were far away from the stars and where the orbits were all nicely aligned in the same plane. And so we now know that this is not true, that there are giant planets very close to their stars, and now we also know that their orbits need not be aligned so well.
So it is still the final frontier.
It is, very much.
Okay, Joshua Nguyen, Assistant Professor of Physics at MIT, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And now, from the stars in the sky to stars on the screen, remember this classic movie line from actress Vivian Leigh?
But I'll think of some way to get him back. After all, tomorrow is another day.
That, of course, is the well-known final scene from Gone with the Wind, the 1939 Oscar winner for Best Motion Picture. 1939 was a banner year for movies, and many people, including Boston Globe film critic Ty Burr, consider it the year for American filmmaking. But his fellow Boston Globe critic, Wesley Morris, has his own nominee for the Best Motion Picture year. He says it's 1999. He points to this well-known film, which spawned not only two sequels, but a host of imitations.
The Matrix is everywhere. It is all around us. Even now, in this very room. You can see it when you look out your window, or when you turn on your television. You can feel it when you go to work, when you go to church, when you pay your taxes. It is the world that has been pulled over your eyes to blind you from the truth.
That's Lawrence Fishburne as Morpheus in the 1999 movie The Matrix. To continue the debate over the greatest year for films, we invited Ty and Wesley into the studio. Welcome.
Hi, Deb. How are you?
Ty, let's start with you. You say that 1939 had a body of work that many people say cannot be equaled. Why?
1939 was the year that the American classic film studio industry was at its zenith. There actually was a court case filed the year before that it would lead to the dismantling of the studio system. They had to divest their theaters. But in 1939, and the war hadn't happened, you know, we weren't in the war yet. We were out of the Depression. So you had this industry that was just rocketing ahead on all cylinders. So you had, well, you had, you know, of course, Gone with the Wind is the story of the year. But when you look at the other films that year, there's Only Angels Have Wings, there's The Women, there's Goodbye, Mr. Chips, there's, you know, The Wizard of Oz, there's Stagecoach, there's Dark Victory. It just, all the major film studios were at the top of their game and putting out work that was just peak craft.
Well, he came out strong there, Wesley.
I think I should also start by just disclaiming the debate aspect of this setup. I'm not arguing against 1939 being one of the great years for movies.
Yes, you are.
But,
yes,
well,
you are.
Okay, then fine. I'm
no,
arguing
it's not it, true but that we go to bars and get drunk and angrily take this outside and say, 1939.
But, I mean, I do think that for a variety of reasons, I think 1999 was also a watershed year for, if not in terms of what we'll be looking back at 60 years from now, then at least in terms of what that year meant for the way we get our movies and the types of movies we got. Unlike the studio system in 1999, movies came from everywhere. I mean, they came from studios, they came from people with digital video cameras. That's how we got the Blair Witch Project. There was no sort of organized source for filmmaking. And I think that sense that the world was sort of turning upside down also made its way into the content of those movies. I mean, that was a year in which the movies were agitated and paranoid and dyspeptic and dystopic. That was the year that we got The Matrix. We got South Park's musical about the end of the world, basically. We got The Sixth Sense. We got Fight Club. I mean, we got Dick, a movie in which two girls sort of have a sexual obsession with Richard Nixon. It was a comedy. There were so many movies that came out that year. Not all of them were even great, but they all seemed to me, anyway, to tap into a very fundamental discomfort with moving away from the 20th century and into the 21st.
I mean, look, you can play this game with any year. And in fact, you know, I pointed out in the original article that you could say 1975, you know, where you had Nashville and a lot of other great movies, or 1986, our peak years. I think the industry and the popular culture goes in cycles. Cycles of imitation and cycles of innovation. And cycles of professionalism, which is really what 1939 is. It is the year, the peak year of the professional American film industry, when they're turning out works of such craft that aren't, you know, necessarily long-lasting vision, but that are still pleasurable and still have meaning.
We're speaking with Boston Globe film critics Ty Burr and Wesley Morris, who wrote about two watershed years in filmmaking, 1939 and 1999. And Wesley, before the break, we were talking about how 1999 films reflected the anxiety of that time, as well as the rise of new, unusual films. One prime example, the hugely successful movie, The Blair Witch Project. And just to remind listeners, the movie's about three film students who go into the woods to make a documentary about the Blair Witch. They get lost, and perhaps they come across something supernatural. There was a lot of talk on the internet at the time about whether the film was real. Let's listen to a scene.
Everything had to be my way. And this is where we've ended up. And it's all because of me that we're here now. Hungry and cold and hunted.
The movie itself was an amazing trick. I mean, if you didn't know going in what you were going to see, you left unclear about whether it was actually happening. I think that the genius of this movie, in a lot of ways, is that it taps into something fundamentally entitled about Americans, which is that they kept saying over and over again, we can't be lost. We're not lost. We're in America. It's that sort of suburban fear of wilderness and presumption that because you're an American, you can get out of anything that makes their not being able to get out all the more frightening. Because a normal movie, I think, would have some sort of rescue for them. But there isn't. I mean, the legend of the witch. I mean, and I don't mean to sort of ascribe a value to this movie that doesn't really exist. But I mean, it really does and really did at the time scare people.
Another film that scared people and made a lot of money was The Sixth Sense, and that was with Bruce Willis and Haley Joel Osment, who delivered another famous film line. Let's listen.
I see dead people.
Wesley Morris, that line really went into pop culture.
Yes, that was famous the minute it showed up, and people, I mean, it became the thing that people quoted for years after. And that's another movie where the gimmick was a selling point. I mean, a lot of people didn't know what was happening in the film, and they kept trying to figure out what were these dead people showing up at Haley Joel Osment's door for? Why is Bruce Willis so strange? What's going on?
I found it very interesting that the twist in that movie was not given away. By moviegoers, right. By the pundits, by, you know, the culture.
And Ty, if we go back to the lasting pop culture influences, let's hear another famous movie line. This one is from The Wizard of Oz.
And tap your heels together three times. And think to yourself, there's no place like home. There's no place like home.
I think that film has actually entered the common cultural consciousness of an entire generation. And that's not the generation that was alive when it came out in theaters. That movie actually had an afterlife. Mm-hmm. When that film came to television and it was shown on the holidays, I seem to recall it always seeing it on Thanksgiving. And we watched it every year, The Wizard of Oz. And some of those scenes are so primal that when you see them when you're five, the flying monkeys, the wicked witch, and then suddenly you realize everybody else has seen it so that you can say Toto 2 or pay no attention to that man behind the curtain, and everybody gets right. It.
Surrender, Dorothy, it's a big one. For
It's a generational myth. It's a generational myth because we accessed it at a very young age, and but we saw it regularly.
I also think that was one of the first movies I saw where I understood the sort of dream element of what a movie could do. I mean, I dreamt about that movie many, many nights. Mm.
And another cultural icon from that time is Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. That's Frank Capra's movie starring Jimmy Stewart as an idealistic freshman senator.
Oh, absolutely. It's
another one that we all probably remember after holidays.
Not in my dreams,
watching
though.
Some of that. Well, maybe not in your dreams. Hopefully not.
Well, it didn't get the sprockets aired off of it like It's a Wonderful Life did at Christmas time, but it is a movie that's been seen, and every generation has come to it and had to deal with it, to deal with that, you know, what we call Capricorn. Frank Capra made those movies that were both very cynical and really idealistic about the American system. And this is, in a way, his most populist and popular, yet slickest and most resonant movie. It can be really patriotic if you're patriotic. It can be unbearably patriotic if you're, you know, not the type of person who likes to, you know, do flag-waving bromides but looks for something deeper. But that's there as well. As well as all these wonderful Hollywood performances like Gene Arthur and Thomas Mitchell. Mm-hmm. And, of course, you know, Jimmy Stewart giving the performance of his young career as Jefferson Smith. The filibuster scene, you know, is still in everybody's mind. You know, even when you're watching C-SPAN, you kind of are hoping somebody's going to rise up and, you know, give a filibuster and then faint dramatically, and then Claude Rains will run in.
No one's ever given a filibuster as good as that.
No, nobody has.
Get up there with that lady that's up on top of this Capitol dome, that lady that stands for liberty. Take a look at this country through her eyes if you really want to see something. And you won't just see scenery. You'll see the whole parade of what man's carved out for himself after centuries of fighting. And fighting for something better than just jungle law. Fighting so he can stand on his own 2 feet, free and decent, like he was created. No matter what his race, color, or creed.
It's a movie that, you know, is still very much in play, and that sort of everybody has to see if they want to understand the ideals and the cliches behind our idea of what this country is.
Well, let's go back to 1999, Wesley, and election. Mm-hmm. Right? There we go. Another political film.
The Great Election, yes.
Comedy directed by Alexander Payne. We actually have a clip from this one. Would-be politician Tracy Flick is determined to win this high school election, we should say, despite the fact that her opponent, Paul Metzler, is well-connected and popular. So we're going to listen to this scene where Tracy is working on her campaign buttons right after she hears that Paul is her opponent.
He was no competition for me. It was like apples and oranges. I had to work a little harder, that's all. You see, I believe in the voters. They understand that elections aren't just popularity contests. They know this country was built by people just like me, who work very hard and don't have everything handed to them on a silver spoon.
Now, let me just say, yeah, there is your Jefferson Smith for 1999.
Yeah, no, it's, that movie, to me, is in many ways perfect from start to finish. This movie is so timeless and so timely. I mean, you could play it at any time, at any stage in a political situation, and it'll just seem like the freshest, most relevant thing you could possibly have come up with.
Okay, well, we have 1939 with Tiber. We have 1999 with Wesley. We're in 2009. How's 2009 shaping up?
You remember what I said about it being cyclical? I think we're at a down part of the cycle right now.
It's pretty. I mean, you know, the one thing that made me most sad about writing this piece was that there's been nothing in 2009 that is remotely as interesting as the most interesting movies I've seen 10 years ago. So far, I mean, you know, it's August. There's still time.
Right. I mean, if you look back at, you know, the late 90s when the Sundance indie kind of movie was seeming very fresh, and this year you look around and the version of that, which is 500 Days of Summer, which is a movie that I think is cute but is pretty much cliched from beginning to end, and that some people will still persist in thinking of as an independent movie. Well, that model is clearly old,
gone, yeah.
Yeah, and dead, and we're looking for some fresh infusions of filmmaking energy.
That's Ty Burr and Wesley Morris, both of the Boston Globe, to read their columns on the films of 1939 and 1999 or their movie blog. Go to our website, hereandnow.org. Thanks to both of you for coming in.
Thanks,
Deb.